maybe a good idea to give you an overview of what we looked at in part 31 last time. We left off at the end of chapter 6 of 2 Samuel, so if you'd like to be turning there, 2 Samuel chapter 16, did I say 6? Chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, and let's just review what we went through last time. So David and his followers were fleeing from David's rebellious son Absalom and Absalom's army, and they were heading east towards what David referred to as the plain in the wilderness. When they arrived at the eastern boundary of the city of Jerusalem, David sent the Ark of the Covenant back to the city, back into Jerusalem, accompanied by the Levitical high priest by the name of Abiathar, and another chief priest by the name of Zadok, and their two sons, and with giving them the responsibility of serving David as spies. David and his followers continued and arrived at the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is a hill that was and certainly is, still is, so very significant to the Jews generally, to the sorrows of the Jews generally, and to David's super special Jewish descendant, the Lord Jesus, of course, and to his followers, and to their sorrows. I'm talking about his followers at that time, his disciples, of course. We took a break from 2 Samuel and we read Psalm 3 and its significance to David's flight and to David's sorrow at having to quit Jerusalem. And he later referred to Jerusalem 10 times in various scriptures as the holy city. All of those 10 times went by David, but in the scriptures referred to Jerusalem as the holy city, the city which had been given to David by the Lord God as a gift. We continued, we read David assigned another spy who was a Gentile proselyte by the name of Hushai the Archite, and David sent him back to Jerusalem as well in order to serve as a kind of double agent and to assist Zadok and Abiathar and their sons in the transmitting of the details of Absalom's movements back to David and his generals. And then we read of Ziba, a man by the name of Ziba, who was the head servant of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth, as we have read and will read again, that he had become treacherous against David. Just to remind you that Mephibosheth was the son of David's late great Benjamite friend Jonathan, and Mephibosheth was the grandson of the late King Saul. And so Ziba transferred his service and his loyalty from Mephibosheth over to David. Again, like many other Israelites, Mephibosheth had treacherously turned from his support of David. David, who had been so generous to himself and his family, to support Absalom, or ostensibly to support Absalom. And I say ostensibly because Mephibosheth faked his support for Absalom in a foolish and vain hope for the restoration of the Israelite throne to himself and to his own Benjamite family. Okay, as David and his followers continued their slow trek eastward, another Benjamite by the name of Shimei came and began a passionate, ceaseless tirade cursing David. David could have had Shimei executed, but David spared him, and he accepted some of Shimei's accusations as partially true and as part of his just punishment from the Lord for his sins against Bathsheba and her husband. Meanwhile, Absalom and his army eventually arrived at Jerusalem, accompanied by Ahithophel, who was the newly treacherous ex-counselor of David, and came to Absalom to serve as his counselor, hoping to be his number one counselor. Now, after some initial suspicions, along comes Hushai, who volunteered to be a counselor as of Absalom. And again, Absalom was initially suspicious of Hushai, but then he accepted him. Ahithophel suggested that Absalom publicly cement his victory over David by quote-unquote going into David's concubines, and Absalom did that, and so fulfilling another of the Lord's prophesied punishments on David for his great sins against Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. And with that very negative event, last time in part 31, we left the two parties. So now, as we continue with our history, we're at the close now of chapter 16, and we'll move on in a minute into chapter 17, and we find the treacherous, vain, clever, but very convincing Ahithophel continuing to figure prominently, very prominently. So 2 Samuel chapter 16 verse 23. 2 Samuel chapter 16 verse 23. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. In other words, they trusted his word so much that it was almost as though they were inquiring at the most holy place of God's tent tabernacle, actually seeking the word of the Lord. Still in verse 23, so was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David formerly and with Absalom now. So his word was trusted. So on we go now, seamlessly, into chapter 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak-handed, and will make him afraid. And will make him afraid. Not likely. And all the people that are with him shall flee. And I will smite the king only. And I will bring back all the people unto you. The man whom you seek is as if all returned. So all the people shall be in peace. So, seeking brownie points from Absalom here, this Ahithophel proposed a reunification of Israel, which had been divided, by Absalom's treachery, but also according to the Lord's will, as another result of his punishment upon David. But notwithstanding what Ahithophel had promised, any reunification, and this is important for us to remember, brethren, any reunification of Israel must be according to the Lord's will. He, the Lord, is the one who orchestrated the split, and he is the one who must heal the split. And once again, brethren, this is a hugely important lesson for us, a hugely important lesson for the people of the extremely fragmented spiritual Israel of God today. Don't have to turn there, but much later in the Gospel accounts, Jesus is quoted as famously warning that what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And the likewise, the converse is also very true. What God has put asunder, let no man vainly attempt to join back together. No man. Not even the high ups of physical Israel, or not even the head ministers of the spiritual Israelite churches of God. Reunification of the spiritual Israel of God's church is not within the limits of any man's authority or responsibility. We have to remember that, brethren. It is God's job. It's according to his perfect will and his perfect timing. Whether it be physical Israel bringing, you know, the Jews back together with all of the other tribes of Israel, or whether it be the reunification of spiritual Israel, God's church, it will happen when God deems the time to be right, and not one second sooner. And again, likewise, back in the physical Israel of David's time. So with all of that in mind, let's go back there and continue in verse 4. And the saying, in other words, Ahithophel's suggestion, pleased Absalom well, and all the elders of Israel. The elders of Israel being Absalom's secondary counselors, if you will. It says, all the elders of Israel, okay, we say all of them except one. And from that one, Absalom now requested a second opinion. Verse 5. Then said Absalom, call now Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear likewise what he says. And we can imagine Ahithophel frowning seriously at this suggestion. His face would go black, I think. Verse 6. And when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom spoke unto him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken after this manner. Shall we do after his saying? If not, speak you. In other words, do you have an alternate plan? If so, let's hear it. Verse 7. And Hushai said unto Absalom, remember, Hushai was a spy for David and working on David's behalf. The counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. Not good at this time. And, you know, we read into that, yeah, maybe it might be good at some other time, but the way things are right now, no, no. And here's why. Verse 8. For, said Hushai, you know your father, David, and his men, that they be mighty men. You know, Ahithophel said that they were going to chicken out, that they were going to bring fear into David. Most of David's men were likely battle-hardened soldiers of the tribe of Judah, the militarily superior tribe of Judah. We're going to come back to that in a couple of minutes. Still in verse 8. And they be chafed in their minds as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And your father, David, is a man of war, and will not lodge with the people, will not lodge with his army. Behold, he is hid now in some pit or in some other place, and it will come to pass when some of them be overthrown at the first, that whosoever hears it will say, there is a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. And he also amongst Absalom's army, that is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and they which be with him are valiant men. Again, the militarily superior Jews. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto you. All Israel be generally gathered unto you from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that is by the sea for multitude. In other words, Ahithophel had said, let me get together an army of 12,000. Hushai is saying, go out to all the tribes and get an absolutely huge army, way more than Ahithophel's 12,000. And then to add to that, he said that you go to battle in your own person. Okay, and of course he was picking at Absalom's vanity right there. Verse 12, so shall we come upon him, upon David, in some place where he shall be found, and we will light upon him as dew falls on the ground, and of him and of all the men that are with him there shall not be left so much as one. So Ahithophel said, we'll go in, we'll just kill David. What Hushai was saying, we'll go in, we'll kill all of them. But again, we know that he was speaking actually on David's behalf. And the other thing that he was doing, that Absalom, in order to go out and get all of those soldiers from all of the other tribes, that would take some time, and that would give David some time to get further away and to prepare his own battle plans. So so Hushai, the crafty Hushai here, perhaps inspired in his words by the Lord God, he embellished his plan. It was just like putting icing on a cake. Verse 13, again, this is Hushai speaking. Moreover, if he be gotten into a city, then shall all Israel, like this huge Israelite army, bring ropes to that city, and we will draw it into the river until there be not one small stone found there. Interesting that they would, or even could, think that they could do that. And you know, we know from what the Romans did to Jerusalem and to the temple that those things were actually possible. Anyway, I don't want to get off the subject. And okay, to the mortification of Ahithophel, verse 14, and Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. And that proclamation there was for good reason, and here it is. For the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel. So the good counsel, it wasn't good counsel, but the Lord had appointed to defeat it, to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom, but not upon Absalom only, but also upon the rejected Ahithophel. So with his plan, with Hushai now, with his plan accepted by Absalom, Hushai now needed to get word to David quickly. So verse 15, then said Hushai unto Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, were Hushai's fellow spies, of course, is what Hushai said. Thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now therefore, send quickly and tell David, saying, lodge not this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up, and all the people that are with him. Verse 17. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz, okay, remember these were the faithful sons of Zadok and Abiathar. Jonathan and Ahimaaz were the runners, if you like, intermediate runners, messengers who ran between David's three faithful Jerusalem-based spies and David himself. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed by En-Rogel, for they might not be seen to come into the city. So being pretty crafty there, En-Rogel was a place near Jerusalem, but it was just on the border between the tribal territories of Judah and Benjamin. Still in verse 17, and a wench went and told them. Okay, a wench, this wench was a female, a faithful female servant, possibly a servant of Zadok's or Abiathar's, and perhaps a young woman who would not normally have attracted any suspicion. A wench went and told them, went and told Jonathan and Ahimaaz, and they went and told King David. Okay, more accurately though, they started on their way to tell King David. Nevertheless, in verse 18, nevertheless, a lad who was loyal to Absalom saw them, okay, saw them talking to this woman and told Absalom. But they, the two lads there, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, went both of them away quickly and came to a man's house in Bahurim, which had a well in his court, into which they went down. And the woman, likely the same faithful wench mentioned in verse 17, took and spread a covering over the well's mouth, so that, you know, these pursuers would not know that it was a well, and spread ground corn thereon, and the thing was not known. Okay, so ground corn on there, yeah, looking as though they had the corn out there to dry or something like that. That's a good job these guys didn't try and walk on it. Anyway, so this woman, this wench, she was not only faithful, but she was brave, and she was very smart too. Verse 20. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman, to the house, they said, where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said unto them, oh, they be gone over the brook of water. And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. And it came to pass after they, Absalom's servants, were departed, that they, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, came up out of the well and went and told King David, and said unto David, arise and pass quickly over the water, talking about the river Jordan, pass quickly over the river Jordan, for thus has Ahithophel counseled against you. Now it's interesting that Absalom didn't go after Zadok and Abiathar, but who knows, maybe he was too busy with his battle plans. But meanwhile, or maybe, you know, he was in a hurry to get on and get after David. Meanwhile, David wisely heeded the warnings from his faithful spies, and he took a defensive position. Initially, a defensive position anyway. Verse 22. And David arose, and all the people were with him, and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan. And by the morning light, there lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. Now that's significant, because the River Jordan would have been, especially if it was in full flood, the River Jordan would have been an excellent protective or defensive barrier when Absalom's armies arrived. So it would certainly slow down a larger, I think David had a decent sized army, but by this time Absalom would have had pulled together this huge army. Okay. Back in Jerusalem, we find Ahithophel now pouting and, as we say in England, chucking his dummy. Verse 23. And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order, and hanged himself and died, and was buried in the sepulchre of his father. And so another enemy of David, another enemy of the Lord God, passes into history. And after his evil treachery against David, we certainly cannot justify any sympathy for this man, Ahithophel. So let's move on then. Verse 24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. So by this time then, David and his followers had travelled all the way up north to a town called Mahanaim in Gilead. And of course Absalom was quite a ways behind, but Absalom of course pursued David and his army. Jump down to verse 26. So Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. But by the time Absalom's party arrived, David had found much kind and friendly support up there. And in England we think of northern hospitality. And this was like northern hospitality in the land of Israel. And some of this hospitality was from somewhat surprising sources. Verse 27. And it came to pass, when David was come to Mahanaim, that Shobi the son of Nahash of Rabbah of the children of Ammon, and Machir the son of Amiel of Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite of Rogalim. Why is it surprising that they would give him hospitality? First of all, because Nahash was the king of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites were Israel's former enemy. Secondly, Machir was Bathsheba's brother. And we know that Machir had formerly resided with Mephibosheth, who we now know had become treacherous against David. So, you know, normally we wouldn't have known where Machir's loyalties lay. But, okay, Amiel was the father of Bathsheba and Machir, and was the son of the late treacherous Ahithophel. Okay, so we see those links there. And so it is somewhat surprising that they would give such support to David, but they did. What was the kindness that these men showed to David and his followers up there in Gilead? Verse 28. They brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulse and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kine for David and for the people that were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. So in short, these men made life a lot more comfortable for David and his group of faithful nomads during this time of their sorrowful exile. So now we move on into chapter 18. And we find here that David now began preparing his military strategy, because he knew what was coming. So 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 1. And David numbered the people that were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. So these numbers now, the fact that there were thousands, these numbers indicate how much David's faithful army had grown. Verse 2, and David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people of his army, I will surely go forth with you myself also. So David certainly had not lost any of his great Jewish courage, and he wanted to lead his armies in this civil war. Why did he want to be directly involved? Why did he? Perhaps in order to impose limits on their violence against the Israelite countrymen, and especially for their leader, for David's beloved but rebellious son, Absalom. Verse 3, but the people, in other words, the army's spokesman, David, the spokesman for David's armies, answered, You shall not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for you, for us, okay, they will not care about us, neither if half of us die will they care about us. But now you are worth 10,000 of us. And again, those numbers are another indication of the size of David's army at that point in time. Still in verse 3, therefore now it is better that you succor us out of the city. When it says out of the city, it actually means in the city of Manahim. So David's military counselors were advising him here that as their commander-in-chief, he could better support his armies remotely rather than on the battlefield itself. And that would be like King George VI did in the Second World War, and Winston Churchill did as well, that they, you know, stayed behind in London and led the battles from there. But maybe, in David's case here, and even probably, one of those military counselors must have been Joab, and we know that Joab was strict in his feelings that the death penalty was right for Absalom, despite David's irrational love for his son, and for David's desire for Absalom to survive. Verse 4. And the king said unto them, okay, what seems you best I will do. And so David yielded to their advice and stayed behind in the safety of the city. And he led his army from there as best as he could, using runners or messengers. And the army went out of the city of Manahim to the battleground. Still in verse 4, and the king stood by the gate side, and all the people of his army, came out by hundreds and by thousands. There's those high numbers again. Verse 5, and the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. But we don't read of any agreement to David's commands by the three generals. They, of course, being so very aware of the serious level of Absalom's evil treachery. Verse 6. So the people of David's army, went out into the field against Israel, in other words, against Absalom's army. And the battle was in the wood of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. And it was their great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. Now, I've referred to this before today, but when I arrived at this point in the Bible narrative, something very interesting and significant jumped out at me. And that is this. In these recent chapters describing Absalom's rebellion, his followers, like Absalom's followers and his army, have frequently been referred to as Israel. Whereas David's army and his other faithful followers are frequently being referred to as the people, in, translated from the tiny Hebrew word Am, A-M, Am. My question is this, is it possible then that during this conflict between David and Absalom, David's followers mostly, as a whole, were made up of people from the tribe of Judah? And if so, this would not have been the first time that the tribe of Judah had been at odds with the other tribes of Israel. And it certainly would not be the last. In this regard, let's not forget the Lord's Genesis 49 prophecy that he gave through the aging Jacob, especially with regards to Judah's military prowess, including the Jews' prophesied conflicts with and their military superiority over all of their other non-Jewish Israelite brethren. Okay, I'll just read it to you. Genesis chapter 49, verse 8. You don't have to turn there. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hands shall be in the neck of your enemies. And let me add in there, including your Israelite brethren, if and when they become your enemies. He says, your father's children shall bow down before you. So we see that there. We see that prophecy right from the beginning, and we've seen that military prowess and superiority that the tribe of Judah has, and it's important as we go through to remember these things. Okay, let's back in 2 Samuel 18 and continuing in verse 8. Okay, so that. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood or the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. The wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. I'm not sure why, but perhaps in their panic, many of Absalom's fleeing men might have literally been devoured by wild animals such as bears, lions, snakes and insects, all of them would have been native to that area at that time, or perhaps from other natural hazards of that fearsome forest. And one of those hazards was one that the vain, long-haired Absalom now encountered. In verse 9, and Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule. He was fleeing from them, of course, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and it was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. So once again, brethren, hope it doesn't happen to any long-haired men that you know, but long hair on men is forbidden by the Lord in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And here we see one case of an automatic consequence of disobedience to that rule. Verse 10, and a certain man saw it and told Joab, and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak. And Joab said unto the man that told him, and behold, you saw him, and why didn't you smite him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 shekels of silver. and a girdle. Girdles of this kind back then were apparently some kind of fancy belt. Possibly they were given for extraordinary acts of bravery. And I think what it reminds me of is something like the prize belts that are awarded to modern day professional boxers. You know, the, I can't remember the name of those famous belts that are given to professional boxers. Anyway, verse 12. And the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, yet would I not put forth my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise I should have wrought falsehood against my own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. And then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with you. In other words, I don't have time to hang around arguing with you about this. And he took 3 darts, probably not darts as we know them, but perhaps spears or lances, in his hand, and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the yoke. Okay, just to note here that the Hebrew word for heart is lev, L-E-V. The Hebrew word for the midst, like the midst of the yoke, is also lev. And 10 young men that bear Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. So now the vain, evil, wicked, rebellious Absalom was dead. Who killed him? Was it Joab? Or was it the 10 young men? Well, we'll talk about that next time. I believe that this is as good a place as any for us to finish for today. So we'll come back and answer that question next time.